Welcome everyone to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Wednesday, February 4th, and we're bringing you the Blockchain and Digital Assets Edition, a deep dive, to say the least. I'm Maya, and alongside me as always is Alex.
Always a pleasure, Maya. And it's a fascinating edition, truly. You know, observing the evolution of blockchain technology feels a bit like witnessing a controlled experiment in materials science. We're meticulously layering protocols, testing their resilience under pressure, and seeing entirely new properties, like permissionless value transfer, emerge from the interactions.
A little poetic, Alex. But I love it. Look, the question everyone's asking is, how are stablecoins evolving beyond just being pegged to the dollar? We're seeing some seriously interesting developments in payments, too.
Exactly. And it all ties back to the broader macroeconomic forces at play. The market dynamics this week are complex, to say the least.
You're telling me. Regulatory landscape is shifting rapidly and compliance is a minefield. You caught something interesting there, didn't you?
I did. There's something fascinating happening at the intersection of AI and blockchain. It's not just about efficiency gains, it's about fundamentally reshaping trust models.
Oh, really? I hadn't fully connected that yet. And finally, we'll be digging into the deep end of infrastructure, decentralized networks, and what it really takes to scale. Let's dive in. So I want to kick off our discussion today with something that's fundamentally reshaping the global financial landscape, the evolution of stablecoins and their impact on payments. It's not just about crypto anymore, it's about challenging the existing architecture of how money moves. Alex, where do you see the biggest shifts happening right now?
Well, Maya, the sheer velocity of change is remarkable. We're moving beyond the initial hype cycle and seeing real-world utility emerge, particularly around cross-border payments and access for underserved populations. The key takeaway from the Codex discussion, I think, is that we're witnessing the nascent stages of on-chain FX markets that could genuinely disrupt the $7 trillion foreign exchange industry. They've already hit $1 billion in run rate volume, which is a phenomenal early indicator.
$1 billion is impressive, but is it sustainable? The roll-up consistently highlights regulatory headwinds. What's your read on the Clarity Act and the potential for regulatory capture that Heian and Lee mentioned?
It's a significant concern, certainly. The stalled Clarity Act creates a vacuum where regulatory frameworks are unclear, and that invariably favors incumbents. The risk of regulatory capture, where established institutions influence regulations to stifle competition, is very real. Traditional FX systems are inefficient, hierarchical, and characterized by price discrimination, so any attempt to solidify those advantages is a direct impediment to progress. We need genuinely neutral regulation, and that's proving elusive.
And that's why these regional stablecoins are gaining traction, right? Offering a banking rail, as Heianen put it, with cheaper FX and higher yields compared to local fiat. It's a fascinating dynamic. But it's not just about cost savings, is it? It's also about access.
Precisely. The access element is critical. These regional stablecoins provide a pathway to financial inclusion for populations excluded from traditional banking systems. Think about remittances, for instance. They can bypass the exorbitant fees and delays associated with traditional money transfer services. It's a compelling use case, especially in emerging markets. We're seeing that reflected in the rise of agentic payments, which, as we heard from Wallet Connect, are poised to explode.
Absolutely. And it ties into this idea of Griffin companies, the blend of crypto native and traditional finance expertise. Are those really the key to unlocking the full potential, as the Codex discussion suggested?
I think so. It's not enough to just build a stablecoin. You need a deep understanding of the real-world needs, particularly in emerging markets. It requires the agility of a crypto startup, combined with the regulatory and operational expertise of a traditional financial institution. Simply replicating Tether's model, as they pointed out, won't cut it. We need differentiated, valuable primitives.
So less about generic chain adoption and more about building these specific primitives. Like offering the cheapest possible FX conversions.
Exactly. It's a shift in focus. The industry needs to move away from token incentives and focus on providing core utility. The discussion around incentivized token distribution models, particularly in the context of non-dollar stablecoins, highlights the need for intelligent structuring, not just speculative incentives.
Now let's shift gears slightly. The curated credit discussion painted a different picture of DeFi lending. It's not just about stablecoins, but about the evolving risk landscape. How do you see the curator-driven underwriting model shaping the future?
It's a significant evolution. The migration of risk upwards to a smaller set of curators is a concentration of risk that warrants close scrutiny. It's a shift from protocol-level governance to curator-level decision-making, exposing depositors to more explicit risk. Transparency is absolutely crucial in this environment, and the emphasis on portfolio concentration maps, liquidity coverage metrics, and attestation for off-chain exposures is vital for building trust.
And that ties into the concern about white-labeled stablecoins, doesn't it? The need to do due diligence on those SPVs.
Absolutely. It adds a layer of complexity. You can't just look at the collateral on the surface. You need to understand the underlying structure and risks. This is where the specialized expertise of those Griffin companies becomes invaluable. It requires a level of forensic financial analysis that many DeFi protocols currently lack.
The curated credit discussion also mentioned the potential for capital flight from traditional banks to stablecoins. Do you think that's a realistic scenario?
It's more likely than many people realize. Even if it's not a dramatic exodus, the gradual compression of interest rates as capital flows into stablecoins could benefit borrowers. It's a dynamic often overlooked in the debate surrounding stablecoin regulation, and it highlights the potential for stablecoins to disrupt traditional banking models. The entire financial system is trending towards being on-chain, which is a profound shift.
Speaking of shifts, let's talk about the broader market trends. The BitGet CEO's discussion pointed to a move away from purely crypto-native altcoins towards mainstream assets. Is that a sign of maturity or a capitulation?
I see it as a sign of maturity. The initial excitement around purely speculative crypto assets is fading, and investors are increasingly focused on assets with fundamental value, tokenized US stocks, gold, silver. It's a convergence of crypto and traditional finance, and it's being driven by both institutional and retail demand. The growth of Hyperliquid with its on-chain trading of traditional assets is a clear indication of this trend.
And that's where the tokenization of assets comes in, right? Enabling DeFi composability and yield generation. But it's not just about tokenizing SPVs anymore, is it?
No, the ultimate architecture is direct issuer tokenization, companies issuing shares natively on-chain. That eliminates intermediaries, enables self-custody, and unlocks programmable collateral. It's a future state distinct from current custodian or SPV-based models, and it represents a significant shift in power dynamics.
It's a fascinating vision. Now, pivoting to a more concerning aspect, the North Korean hacking discussion, the scale of these attacks is truly alarming.
It is.
The Lazarus Group's sophistication and persistence are deeply troubling. The exploitation of Telegram vulnerabilities, the use of native macOS malware, and the meticulous laundering of funds demonstrate a level of technical expertise and operational discipline that is rarely seen. What I found particularly striking was their meticulous data analysis of victims' on-chain activity. They're learning from their mistakes and refining their techniques.
And what's the most important takeaway from that conversation in your view?
The need for constant vigilance and robust security practices. Hardware wallets are crucial, but only if seed phrases are not stored on the same device. Even security-conscious individuals are vulnerable, highlighting the importance of OPSEC. It's a constant arms race. The entire system is a complex map, constantly redrawn by both attackers and defenders, a cartographic battleground for financial supremacy.
A very apt metaphor, Alex. And a fitting conclusion to our discussion of stablecoin evolution and payments. It's clear that this space is undergoing a profound transformation, and the next few years will be critical in shaping its future. That captures the essence of what's happening in this space. So let's dive into something that's been dominating the crypto conversation, macroeconomic influences and market dynamics. It feels like Bitcoin's price is less about what's happening within the blockchain space and more about what's happening with the Fed and global liquidity. Alex, your thoughts?
Precisely. We're seeing a decoupling, or at least a significant distortion, between the perceived fundamentals of Bitcoin, its scarcity, its decentralization, and the forces of macroeconomics. The recent price action, for instance, is less about adoption milestones and more about the divergence in liquidity between China and the US, as highlighted in the Unblocking the Chain podcast. It's unprecedented, this simultaneous increase in Chinese liquidity and decrease in US liquidity.
Right. And that podcast also mentioned Kevin Walsh's potential policies, the balance sheet reduction, lower rates, steeper yield curve, all of that impacting markets. But it's not just the Fed, is it? Rory Murray on Blockspace emphasized the geopolitical landscape, Greenland-EU trade tensions, Japan's bond yield situation, the yen carry trade, it's a web of interconnected factors.
Absolutely. And the Japanese yen carry trade is a particularly crucial element. It's been a decades-long mechanism, and its unwinding, as Rory pointed out, could trigger a systemic shift in global capital flows. It's not just about Bitcoin, it's impacting US treasuries, gold, and everything in between. Think of it like a complex tapestry, Maya. Each thread, the Fed policy, geopolitical tensions, the yen trade, is intricately woven together. And when one thread is pulled, the whole pattern shifts. That's precisely what we're seeing now. It's a deliberate and intricate pattern shift.
A tapestry. I like that. Very apt. And speaking of patterns, the gold rally is fascinating. Tether's investment in gold up to 140 tons is significant. That's not just retail investors piling in, that's a strategic move by a major player. Do you think we're seeing a shift in sentiment towards gold as a reserve currency, potentially impacting Bitcoin's narrative?
It's certainly a possibility. Central banks accumulating gold, coupled with fiat currency debasement, reinforces Bitcoin's potential as a hedge. But the current gold price action, as noted in On the Brink, is also being driven by sovereign government sales and a reevaluation of its role. It's a complex interplay. And it's worth noting that CleanSpark's volatility harvesting strategy, selling covered calls, is a fascinating model for navigating this uncertainty.
CleanSpark's approach is interesting, and it highlights the shift towards institutional adoption. Rory Murray mentioned that while it provides stability, it also limits the potential for extreme price fluctuations. Is that a good thing or a bad thing for Bitcoin's long-term growth?
It's a double-edged sword. Greater institutional involvement brings liquidity and legitimacy, but it also tempers volatility. The October 9, 2025 price of $128,000 serves as a psychological marker, impacting long-term holder behavior. But ultimately, long-term appreciation cycles are likely to be more gradual and less prone to parabolic runs.
The SUSD incident at Binance, which came up in Unblocking the Chain, also feels like a symptom of this broader instability. A near $20 billion liquidation that's significant, even within a $3 trillion market. Does it point to deeper systemic issues?
It certainly highlights the interconnectedness of the crypto ecosystem. Binance's role as a major liquidity provider means its actions, while potentially problematic, are a consequence of fulfilling that function. It's not necessarily the primary cause of market downturns, but it certainly amplifies them. The market structure itself is, as Rory Murray described it, bifurcated, disjointed disinformation environment. It's a complex beast.
Absolutely. And let's not forget the regulatory landscape. The potential passage of a diluted Clarity Act, as discussed in Unblocking the Chain, could redefine token classifications and impact Coinbase's ambitions. And the looming threat of a government shutdown, as highlighted in On the Brink, adds another layer of uncertainty.
Yes, and the fact that Coinbase is essentially advocating for no bill is telling. They're calculating that the current regulatory bodies can adapt without legislative intervention. It's a high-stakes gamble.
So looking ahead, what are the key things we should be watching? The Unchained podcast pointed to the shift towards megacap tokens, the rise of tokenized RWAs, and the potential for a mindshare shift back towards crypto.
Precisely. The cyclical nature of the crypto economy, as emphasized in Unchained, means different sectors will experience growth at different paces. And the potential for a reversal of liquidity trends, as suggested by Unblocking the Chain, is a key factor to monitor. We're seeing a shift away from meme coins and speculative altcoins towards more established assets, and that's a trend I expect to continue. The market is maturing, albeit with considerable volatility.
And what about the quantum computing threat? It seems like that's constantly looming and the Bitcoin community's response feels slow.
It's a critical and often overlooked risk. The fact that it's not being prioritized sufficiently by Bitcoin development is alarming. It's not just a theoretical threat, it's a rapidly approaching reality. The failure to address it could significantly discount Bitcoin's value.
It really does feel like we're at a pivotal moment. So the bottom line here is that macroeconomic forces are undeniably shaping the crypto market, and understanding these forces, the liquidity flows, the geopolitical tensions, the regulatory landscape, is crucial for navigating the current volatility.
Indeed.
And it's vital to remember the cyclical nature of markets and the potential for unexpected shifts. We're seeing a recalibration, a restructuring, a complex and often unpredictable process. This is a time for cautious optimism and diligent analysis.
So let's dive into the increasingly murky waters of the regulatory landscape and compliance within the digital asset space. It feels like every week brings a new development, a new interpretation, or a new enforcement action. Alex, where do you see the biggest immediate pressure points?
Well, Maya, I think the SEC's recent guidance on tokenization, as highlighted in the Ava Labs podcast, is profoundly important. They've essentially stated that the format of an asset doesn't change its underlying classification. If it's a security, it's a security, regardless of whether it's a token. That's a massive constraint on innovation. It's like a cinematographer framing a shot. The technical execution is impressive, but if the composition itself is flawed, the entire visual impact is compromised. The structure, the legal architecture, dictates investor rights, and improperly architected tokenization can replicate Wall Street's problems at higher costs.
Exactly. And it's not just about tokenization. We're seeing this play out with stablecoins too, and the potential for them to be treated as cash is gaining traction. That would fundamentally alter the reporting requirements. The BitGo podcast really underscored the regulatory clarity around the Clarity Act and how it's tripling their TAM and could potentially double it again. It's a game changer, but it's also a double-edged sword. Increased clarity can also mean increased scrutiny.
Absolutely, and that scrutiny is already intensifying. The IRS is increasing enforcement, and the 1099-DA forms, while intended to provide clarity, are creating a whole new layer of complexity, as discussed in the Unchained podcast. Taxpayers now have to reconcile exchange-provided proceeds with their own cost basis calculations, potentially triggering audits. And the shift to wallet-by-wallet accounting is forcing a much more granular approach to record-keeping.
It's daunting. And the situation is further complicated by the ongoing jurisdictional battles between the SEC and CFTC. It's a scary environment, as they put it. The potential for Congress to expand the SEC's authority, which seems increasingly likely, could dramatically reshape the regulatory framework. It's a power grab, really.
Precisely. And the fact that exchanges may be subtly lobbying for the CFTC to gain broader authority adds another layer of complexity. It's a chess game, and the players aren't always transparent about their motivations. The Yates memo and CZ's imprisonment, as referenced in that same podcast, also demonstrate the real-world consequences of regulatory ambiguity and noncompliance.
Let's talk about debanking. The Trump lawsuit, while seemingly frivolous, hints at a potential resurgence of Chokepoint 2. The narrative is often framed as banks being victims, but the Unchained podcast highlighted how regulators actively pressured them. That's a concerning precedent.
It's deeply troubling, and the legal landscape surrounding debanking is incredibly complex. Banks' quasi-regulatory role demands greater oversight and potential constitutional amendments or discrimination statutes. It's not just about political views, it's about due process.
And then there's the government's handling of seized crypto. The U.S. Marshals Service's security protocols seem lax, to say the least. It raises serious questions about the government's capacity to safeguard digital assets. It's a vulnerability that surpasses even concerns about state actor attacks.
It's a systemic issue reflecting broader problems in government contracting. The reliance on third-party contractors introduces inherent risks. And the lack of a technical Fort Knox for crypto asset storage is simply unacceptable.
So looking ahead, what's one concrete prediction you'd make about the regulatory landscape in the next year?
I predict we'll see a significant push for greater harmonization of regulations across different jurisdictions, driven by the increasing interconnectedness of the global crypto market. But it will be a slow, incremental process, fraught with political and economic challenges.
A slow burn. All right, let's wrap up. So the bottom line here is that navigating the regulatory landscape in the digital asset space requires vigilance, meticulous record keeping, and a proactive approach to tax planning. It's a complex environment, but one that is rapidly evolving. That captures the essence of what's happening in this space. So let's dive into something fascinating, the convergence of AI and blockchain. It's a space buzzing with potential, but also rife with new security concerns. Alex, where do you see the biggest intersection right now?
Well, the immediate impact is on crypto security, as highlighted by the North Korean Lazarus Group attacks. Their rapid iteration and domain spinning to evade MetaMask's protections, it's a constant arms race. The fact they're writing native Mac malware in Rust and Swift, specifically targeting crypto users, is particularly concerning. It demonstrates a clear shift in focus.
Absolutely. And it's not just sophisticated nation-state actors. We're seeing a democratization of AI tooling, making these techniques more accessible. CloudBot, for instance, is lowering the barrier to entry for even non-technical individuals to build and deploy malicious code. Do you think this is fundamentally changing the threat landscape?
Without question, it's accelerating. The recursive self-improvement loop in agentic AI coding gets easier, leading to more tools, which simplifies coding further. It's an exponential growth cycle. It's like performing a delicate microsurgical procedure, where a slight tremor in one hand can have cascading consequences across the entire operation. The AI landscape is rapidly evolving, and the infrastructure needs to keep pace.
That's a brilliant analogy, Alex. The precision required is astonishing. The Unchained podcast also touched on agentic finance, suggesting Ethereum might have one-upped Bitcoin in its ability to support this. What's the core advantage there?
Ethereum's 24/7 availability and low-cost payments are crucial. Legacy financial systems are inherently human-centric, with closing hours and API costs. Crypto, and particularly Ethereum, offers a fundamentally better foundation for AI agents operating continuously. This enables entirely new commerce categories beyond simple micropayments.
And it's not just about transactions. The DAO Security Fund, born from the ashes of the 2016 hack, is a fascinating example of self-correction within the ecosystem. It's a closed-loop feedback system, isn't it?
Exactly. And it's funded by Unclaimed ETH, demonstrating a persistent vulnerability, user awareness, and asset recovery. It's a stark reminder that even with hardware wallets, storing seed phrases on a compromised device negates their security.
It's almost ironic. Hardware wallets are often touted as the ultimate protection, but a single lapse in judgment can undo all that. The Bell Curve podcast highlighted the importance of ERC 8004 for agent identity. Is that going to be key to building trust in this space?
Absolutely. Establishing verifiable identities for AI agents is paramount. Reputation alone won't cut it. Collateral potentially leveraging agent layer is increasingly viewed as a vital guarantee for agent actions. It's a shift from trusting reputation to requiring a stake in the outcome.
So what's one prediction you'd make about this convergence in the next 6-12 months?
I think we'll see a significant breakthrough in agent coordination. Not just smarter individual agents, but the ability to create and manage swarms of agents effectively. It's the next critical bottleneck to overcome.
It's a fascinating area. The rapid commoditization of AI infrastructure could shift value accrual towards open source solutions, and we'll need to see how standards like X402 evolve. It's a landscape of immense opportunity, but also one requiring constant vigilance.
Precisely. The risks are real, but so is the potential. It requires a proactive and adaptive approach, constantly monitoring and evolving strategies to counter emerging threats.
That captures the essence of what's happening in this space. The intersection of AI and blockchain is not just a technological shift, but a fundamental reevaluation of trust, security, and the very nature of digital commerce. So now moving on to our next topic, deep-end infrastructure and decentralized networks. It's a mouthful, but the potential here is seismic. Alex, what's grabbing your attention most about this emerging space?
Well, Maya, the sheer scale of what DABA is achieving is remarkable. 75,000 hotspots in 18 months, serving 500,000 daily users, it's a testament to the deep-end approach. Building the foundational infrastructure, rather than trying to piggyback on existing, often unreliable systems, is a fundamentally different strategy. It's like playing Go, you're not reacting to your opponent's moves, you're strategically placing stones to control the board from the ground up.
Exactly. And that control is key. The managed deployment service, ensuring both efficient installation and verifiable usage, addresses a huge concern with decentralized projects gaming the system. It's a brilliant mitigation. They're essentially baking in accountability from the outset.
Precisely. And the tokenomics incentivizing participation with Genesis points are crucial. It's not just about building the network, it's about building a community around it. The proactive engagement with Indian regulators crafting telecom policy to accommodate these principles is also very impressive, a sign of long-term viability.
They're even exploring on-chain financing. That's a huge shift. Imagine democratizing infrastructure investment in this way. And the potential for DABA to become a platform for other deep-end projects, that's where things get really interesting.
It's a compelling value proposition, isn't it? Not just for investors, but for other developers looking to leverage DABA's on-the-ground presence. The data consumption figures alone are staggering, approaching 1 petabyte per day. That suggests a fundamentally different usage pattern than typical residential broadband.
That's a huge clue. What are people doing on this network? Are we looking at a new digital ecosystem emerging, driven by public Wi-Fi access? And the shift from predominantly home users to a higher percentage using public Wi-Fi, that's a critical inflection point.
It's likely driving data-intensive applications, content streaming, microtransactions, location-based services. And the Bollywood Unlock campaign, a stroke of genius. Leveraging cultural relevance to drive adoption is a far more effective strategy than generic marketing.
Absolutely. And the transparency they're offering through Dabacom, the open data, it's a radical departure from the traditional telecom industry's opacity. It feels like they're deliberately cultivating a decentralized, community-driven network.
Exactly. It's a compelling model for other developing nations facing similar connectivity challenges. I predict we'll see a surge in similar internet-in-a-box solutions over the next 2-3 years, particularly in regions where legacy infrastructure is lacking.
If this continues to scale and we see more projects adopting this deep-end, decentralized approach, the entire telecom landscape could be reshaped. The real question becomes, can these networks truly compete with and eventually displace the established giants?
It's a long game, but DABA's aggressive expansion plans, aiming for 500-600 million connections in India alone, certainly indicate a serious ambition. They're not just building a network, they're building a future.
So as we reach the end of this week's digest, it's striking how seemingly disparate threads, stablecoins, macroeconomic shifts, regulatory pressures, AI integration, and decentralized infrastructure, weave together into a remarkably cohesive narrative. Initially, we were exploring the granular details of on-chain FX markets and DeFi lending, but the underlying force propelling all of these developments is a fundamental restructuring of trust. The traditional centralized models are demonstrably strained, whether it's in payments, financial regulation, or even network security.
Precisely. And if you consider it through the lens of classical architecture, the Roman Forum, for instance, we're witnessing a transition from imposing monolithic structures to a more distributed, resilient design. The Roman Forum wasn't a single impenetrable edifice. It was a collection of interconnected spaces, each serving a specific function, yet contributing to the overall vitality of the city. Similarly, the blockchain ecosystem is evolving from centralized hubs to a network of specialized interoperable modules, each underpinned by decentralized consensus. The ongoing debates around regulatory clarity, for instance, aren't just about compliance. They're about defining the architectural principles of this new digital city.
That's a beautiful analogy, Alex. And it highlights a critical point. The push towards regional stablecoins, the rise of Griffin companies blending crypto-native agility with traditional finance expertise, they're all attempts to build these specialized modules to create more adaptable and resilient components within a larger system. The concerns raised by the North Korean hacking incidents, the potential for debanking, these are reminders that the foundations of this new architecture are still under construction and vulnerabilities remain.
Indeed.
The challenge lies in ensuring that these new structures are not simply replicas of the old, with digital facades concealing the same underlying flaws. The move towards tokenized real-world assets, while promising, must be underpinned by robust due diligence and transparent governance. The focus on agentic AI, as we discussed, necessitates a radical rethinking of identity and accountability. As Cicero observed, the life of a man is best spent in service to the Republic. In this digital republic, we must ensure that the architecture fosters not just efficiency, but also ethical considerations and the equitable distribution of power.
And that's where the deep-end infrastructure projects like DABA become so crucial. They're not just building networks, they're laying the groundwork for a more inclusive and accessible digital future. They're demonstrating that a bottom-up approach, focusing on solving real-world problems, can be just as powerful as top-down mandates. The potential for these networks to reshape the global telecom landscape, particularly in underserved regions, is truly transformative.
Ultimately, the future of this ecosystem hinges on our ability to foster collaboration, transparency, and continuous adaptation. The rapid pace of innovation demands a willingness to embrace experimentation while remaining vigilant against emerging threats. The next 6 to 12 months will be critical in determining whether this new architecture can withstand the inevitable stresses and ultimately deliver on its promise of a more decentralized, resilient, and equitable future.
A truly insightful closing, Alex. It seems we've only scratched the surface of what's possible. Thank you for joining me today on Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. Until next time, stay curious.